Today on Maine Calling, from vaccine recommendations to a surge in whooping cough, health news you can use. If you're confused about whether to get the next COVID vaccine, you are not alone. First, U.S. Health Secretary RFK Jr. announced that COVID vaccines will not be recommended for children and pregnant women anymore. Then, Monday, he ousted every member of the scientific committee that makes federal recommendations about vaccinations. Now, medical providers and public health officials don't know what will be offered at free clinics or what insurance will cover. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Of course, COVID vaccines are not the only public health issue in the news. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss those, plus the latest on whooping cough, measles, avian flu, and tick-borne diseases with two medical leaders. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Vaccinations are very much in the news after controversial announcements on the federal level. Today, we will hear about current vaccine recommendations for a variety of infectious diseases, and we will discuss other seasonal public health concerns here in Maine. Joining us for the hour, Dr. Dora Mills, who is Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, and Dr. James Jarvis, Director of Clinical Education for Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you confused about what shots to get and when, or what to do if a tick bites you? Those are some of the questions we anticipate. What are yours? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you. It's been a while. And why don't I just start by asking you, and I'll start with you, Dr. Jarvis, but I want to know from each of you what you are seeing right now. I know it's a busy time of year in Maine. Has there been a surge in anything unexpected?
Yeah, the good news is no, we have not. We actually are at a low right now in respiratory illnesses. And so I'm definitely knocking some wood on that one, because we have seen a summer surge of COVID since COVID began. But we're hopeful that this year might be a little bit better. All indications are, at least in New England, that viral illnesses are down low. So that's been great news for us. But we have seen an increase in the number of individuals requiring health care. And that's because during the summer season here in Maine, when it's incredibly pleasant here, we get lots of visitors from outside, and we have started to see that kind of summer surge. And also we have those individuals that live in Maine only during the summer months, where they live someplace else during the winter months. And so that has given us the anticipated increase in emergency room visits, walk-in care, and urgent care visits as well. But thankfully, no major events going on right now.
That's great. And Dr. Mills, I'll ask you the same thing. I do know that in summers past, there have been times when hospitals in Maine, including Maine Med, are full. And I'm wondering, have you gotten there yet? And what else would you like to add to what Dr. Jarvis said about what you are seeing in the hospitals of Maine Health?
Well, I would just say ditto to everything Jim said. And yes, a lot of people don't realize that actually the summers in Maine are oftentimes the busiest time for healthcare, because as Jim mentioned, we have both the so-called snowbirds who are home and oftentimes get their surgeries done up here in the summertime, and other kind of elective procedures, and as well as the influx of tourists. So we love to see them. But you know, if you become a patient, if you need to go to the emergency room, for instance, you know, be a patient, but also bring some patients as well. Though, you know, there's certainly times of the day and the evenings that are, you know, much slower than others. So, you know, just sometimes keep that in mind. And sometimes our emergency rooms and urgent care have a little place where you can find out how busy it is too. So, but anyway, we're not overly full or anything like that. So certainly we can take care of everybody. But as Jim said, it tends to be the busier time of year in Maine.
Yeah, Dora, it strikes me that an interpretation of what you're saying is if you think there might be something wrong, don't wait. Just go ahead and go because you might have to wait in the emergency room.
Yeah, so don't wait, but you know, bring a book with you. My mother used to say all the time, she was an English high school English teacher, and she always said, don't go anywhere without a good book because it can turn a wait into a pleasant time. So even if you're sick, go in, but you know, bring a dose of patience as well and maybe a good book.
Okay, Dr. Jarvis, we're going to talk about COVID vaccinations. I think even those of us who tried really hard to keep track of what we had had and what we hadn't had in terms of the dates, the brand name, the all the things we've talked about on Maine Calling Past, even those of us who are trying to do our best are a little confused right now, not sure where we are. Do we need to be, are we at that point where we're getting an annual COVID vaccine? Are most people getting that? Is it a good time to get it in the fall, like many people get their flu vaccine, or not so much? You know, we're getting conflicting advice from the federal government. What are you telling your patients about COVID vaccinations?
So right now I am telling them that there is no new recommendation. So if you are up to date in what we had done for the 2024 winter season, then you should be fine. There's still a carve out there for some individuals who are particularly high risk and if they may be traveling or something like that, where they may have gotten a booster in the spring. But for the most part, I'm not recommending that for most of my patients. Going forward, it is a little murky right now, which is sad to say, because we thought by now we would have had a definite tried and true program. Some of that is because COVID continues to change and continues to baffle us in the way that it's being spread around the world. And then the other is some confusion at the federal level that has very little to do with the knowledge that we have gained in the past, and that's a shame. And because of that, we have some confusing and conflicting things. So we have the head of Health and Human Services saying that they're no longer going to recommend COVID vaccines for healthy individuals under the age of 65, and yet the FDA has recommended that we continue with the same recommendations we have doing, that anybody over 6 months of age probably should get a vaccine when a new vaccine comes out. Why is that concerning? Well, because the manufacturers of vaccines then are hesitant. What should they be doing? We want them to be working on the next booster shot, if that's what we're going to find eventually call it, because we want to be prepared just like we are for the upcoming influenza season. And so there's still a little bit of a gray area. I am very hopeful that this will be worked out, that science will prevail, and we will do what's the right thing. The good news is that we still believe that because the overwhelming majority of the people in the United States have been infected at least one time with COVID, and many of them had gotten at least the initial vaccine, that there is some level of protection there. But we also know that there are people who are at risk, particularly those who are over the age of 65, people who are being treated for chronic health conditions like lung disease, heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, things like that, who are at risk, who may need to continue to get boosters. And then we also know that, unfortunately, healthy people have died from COVID-19. So it is still a real thing. We continue to see cases get admitted to the hospital. And unfortunately, here in the United States, we still see a significant number of deaths due to COVID-19. Hopefully, cooler heads will prevail, and we'll have better guidance as we get closer to those fall months, where we expect that influenza, RSV, and of course COVID will show their ugly heads once again.
And Dr. Mills, if I'm remembering correctly, your start was as a pediatrician. You've seen this recommendation that RFK Jr. says that children do not need a COVID vaccine. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics has put out a statement since his statement saying, you know, that vaccine is very effective and safe and needed in children. In fact, if you look back in the last couple of years, about 40% of children who are hospitalized with COVID actually were unvaccinated. And we know that the hospitalization rates amongst young infants is the same as those as 65, those people who are 65 and older. So it's still a serious disease amongst children. It's as serious as the flu, if not more so. Also, there's the issue that even though his recommendations have been that if you have certain conditions that you can get vaccinated, even if you're younger than 65, They don't include a lot of them that would apply to children, including the fact that if they live with somebody who's high risk. So even if you don't have some of those conditions on the list that he's provided, if you live with somebody who's a high risk, it's another way of protecting them. The vaccine's not 100% effective, so it's nice to have, if somebody's high risk at home, then they have their family members, for instance, vaccinated. Also, pregnant women was on the list that he said that he recommended not, perhaps not getting vaccinated. And ACOG, which is the Academy of College, I'm sorry, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, also came out with a statement very similar to the American Academy of Pediatrics. But ACOG's statement was very much that pregnant women are, we do know, we've known since the beginning that they've been at high risk for hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID, and that they really do need to get vaccinated if, when there's a new vaccine that's out, particularly because they're at high risk, and also to protect their newborns, because we know that when the mother is has immunity, that the newborns also maintain that, have those antibodies for the first few months of their lives when they're actually also at very high risk for hospitalizations and other ill effects. So the associations have come forward with some counter recommendations, or the continuing the what was it recommendations for pregnant women and children to be recommended to be vaccinated. So we'll see, as Jim said, we'll see what happens and hope that science prevails. One of the concerns I should just mention is with the recent firing of the ACIP, the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices for CDC, a lot of insurance coverage is tied to ACIP recommendations. So Medicare Part D, Medicaid, private insurance, others are tied to the ACIP recommendations. So now that there isn't an ACIP, not sure what's going to happen for the fall.
Dr. Jarvis, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to dovetail on what Dora said, about pregnant women. I'm a family physician who's practiced maternity care for over 30 years. The sickest individuals I have cared for were pregnant women with COVID, having to do things that thankfully we have the technology to be able to do that I'd never seen happen to pregnant women in my entire career. And so just echoing again that COVID infections in pregnant women can be incredibly serious. And unfortunately, we actually had to send patients from Maine out of state to get the necessary care that just wasn't available here in Maine. And no one should have to go through that while they're waiting happily, expectantly for a child to come into the world.
All right. Well, I'm going to go to a call a little earlier than usual because I believe this is what John wants to ask about. I'm going to John in Freeport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
My question is, I know what to get. I know how to get it.
Oh,
It's
dear,
not
John, I'm
much.
going to ask you to call back because your reception is not good and we can't hear you. So if you could please call back later in the program. I want to move on to another thing, and that is measles. We're seeing that it's showing up in more and more states. And I believe I'm going to look at you both as I say this. We have not had a measles case in Maine yet, correct?
That's right.
But
That's correct.
I suspect it's only a matter of time because that's how these things work. I found out that I was not immune. I am in a little window, and I want you all to explain it to me better. But Dr. Mills, my understanding is that up until about 1960, most people had been exposed to measles. And then by the end of the 1960s, there was a really effective vaccine. But the first vaccine that was for those who were born in the early and mid-60s was not very good and is not effective. So if you fall into that, you may need to get another vaccine. What would you add to that?
That's right. Well, and it was, I should just mention, it was effective. It just wasn't long lasting.
Ah.
It wasn't lasting. So I was also in that cohort, and I think Jim is as well. So I think
I
the three of us
was.
have in common that we received vaccines. My mother was so proud that I was one of the first, got the vaccine early, and somewhere in the mid 60s. And because my older four siblings all had measles, and she knew from firsthand experience taking care of four different children with measles, how severe of a disease it was, even when it was mild, how severe it was. So she wanted me to get the vaccine as soon as it came out. But I think like yourself and Jim, that I had titers done years later and they were low. So I received a, I think I received a couple more vaccine doses over the years, mostly because I was in either in medicine or I also traveled to places where measles was somewhat endemic. Like I worked in East Africa in the mid 1980s. So if you are in that cohort, so if you were born before 1957, you're then you probably were exposed and had it. You kind of are assumed to have had measles. But if you are born before 1957 and you work in a high risk area, or you're going to be traveling to a high risk area, which is now like West Texas, you may want, and you don't know what your titers are, you may want to consider having a titer done. That is a blood test to show what your level of antibodies are. And you could just call up your PCP and get that, or you could just go and get the vaccine. But it would, you know, for people who are older, you might want to just get the get a titer done first. And then if you're born after 57 or afterwards, then also, and we started recommending two doses of vaccine around 1990, 1989, 1990, where, right around the last big national outbreak, which was 89 and 91. So in there, we realized the reason why we had such a big national outbreak in the late 80s, early 90s was the fact that there was only one dose recommended, and you actually have to have two doses to get your you know, to get your immunity up and remain there for lifelong. So if you were in that cohort of born 57 or later until around 1990, then also you just want to make sure you've had two doses of vaccine, and that again you may, if you're not sure, either get revaccinated or get a titer done. And especially if you're in that cohort that we're in of having gotten the first vaccine, which was the first vaccine was around 60, 1963 to 1968. So if you only get that one dose back then like Jim and Jennifer and I want to get your titers done and make sure you get that other dose. So anyway, but if you were born after about 1990 and you had two doses, you don't need to worry. But if you were born in that older cohort there, then you want to, you know, kind of double check, make sure you've had at least two doses or two doses. And I should mention that in the current outbreak of measles around the country, that a third of the people contracting measles are actually over the age of 20. So it's and they're and they're and the most of the vast majority of people who are contracting measles are in the current outbreak, I think 96% are actually unvaccinated or don't have high immunity because they only received the early dose or that kind of thing. So it is worth checking, especially right now, because it's in about 30 states and people are traveling, and traveling is a way that viruses hitchhike.
And Dr. Jarvis, it's interesting because what strikes me is it doesn't seem as though this is widely known. And it occurs to me that possibly the reason why is the oldest among us, the people who are often the most vulnerable, are indeed in okay shape when it comes to measles, and the youngest among us are. But all of us who are sort of late baby boomers, Gen Xers, we need to pay attention and ask our doctor for some guidance. This is something you might need to bring up in your appointment and not just expect your primary care provider to bring up.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that because again, it isn't well known simply because we actually went through a period where, you know, we had declared measles eradicated from the United States. That is no longer the state. And in fact, it may be that the World Health Organization will declare the US is no longer in that category. And that's alarming to us because we thought we had done a great job. You know, we pretty much eradicated smallpox. We thought measles was going to be next and polio right after that. And unfortunately, that's not the case. The overwhelming number of cases in the past that have been in the United States were from travelers. Oftentimes, they were U.S. citizens who were unvaccinated, and they went to another country, contracted measles, and brought it home. But now we're seeing some people here in the United States who are spreading it to others, and that's the reason why we're dealing with what we're dealing now. And part of that is simply because the vaccination rates amongst children has begun to lower, and that is a problem because then that sets them up for an infection for possibly a traveler, and then they start spreading it to their cohorts. Who then spread it to family, and then we're dealing with the situation we're in right now. And so it's really important. I will say that the CDC just put out a travel alert within the last couple of weeks that said if you're doing international travel, so not travel within the United States, but outside the United States, that you should make sure that you have had the required number of vaccines or have had a titer that shows that you're immune to measles. And that's just simply because we are seeing increases in measles around the globe, not just here in the United States. And you just don't know who's going to be in that airplane with you, the airport with you, or who you're going to be coming in contact with when you travel. So just a good warning there, and a precaution, something that, again, I know Dora has seen cases of measles. I have not seen cases of measles, and I really thought that I would retire before I ever did. Now it's a reality that I probably will before that retirement age comes. So.
And I want to just follow up with a quick email from Barbara. She says, I was born in 1961, and I'm wondering whether I should get an MMR booster or have my blood checked first to determine my antibody levels. What do Maine health officials recommend? And Dr. Jarvis, it sounds as though it doesn't really matter. You can do either one.
Correct. The MMR vaccine that we use right now is very safe, and it has been used for a very long time with lots and lots of data about that. So getting an extra booster probably is not a wrong thing, but I would talk it over with your physician and ask what they recommend for you because everybody has a little bit of difference in their health history, and you just want to make sure that they're doing what's best for you. If you are going to get the MMR, remember it takes at least 2 weeks for it to take maximum effect. So if you're planning international travel, plan accordingly that whether you're going to get titers or get your MMR, that you do so with some wiggle room in there so that you can make sure that your immunity is built up before that travel date.
We do need
And
to
it
take a quick break. There's so much we haven't talked about yet, including whooping cough and ticks. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling, and we are getting a public health update. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, medical and health issues. What's going on right now in the public health field? What are the experts watching? And what do you want to know? Joining us right now, Dr. Dora Mills with Maine Health and Dr. Jim Jarvis with Northern Light. Join our conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. I will start this part of the program with another question. This is from Kim, an email. Kim writes, I have seen more deer and dog ticks in my yard in Greater Portland this spring than I have ever have before. Are others observing the same thing? And are providers in the area seeing more people with tick bites? And if so, are there any new treatments or advice that can be shared? Dr. Jarvis, I know Kim is writing from the Portland area, but I saw you nodding. Are we seeing more ticks statewide?
Absolutely. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it is just warmer. And because of that, our ticks are not going dormant during the wintertime. So they're extremely active all year round now. And the tick population for both deer and dog ticks has just increased significantly here in the state of Maine. Unfortunately, hurting some of our incredible resources here, like the moose and deer that are around our state that we all cherish and love. But it also spills on then over to us as well. And so there is definitely, this is the time of the season where we start to see a lot more individuals coming in. I actually just spoke to a person the other day who said that they were in their doctor's office and was just getting a routine skin check. So they did not have a complaint, and on their back had been an engorged tick. And so when a tick is engorged, it usually means that it has been there for a while. And we usually think about that it has to be attached for about 24 hours or longer before infectious diseases can spread. So in this particular individual's case, they removed the tick and they did start the patient on antibiotics. So that's a call to warning. So one, we should be checking ourselves to see if we have ticks on us, especially after doing any activities outdoors. And then if you do have an engorged tick, you may want to reach out to your provider before symptoms. And then I had one of my own patients who clearly had, actually got an infection from Lyme disease, from a tick, and thankfully did very well with treatment. I'll turn it over to Dora. She's the best one to describe precautions on how to prevent those in the first place.
Well, I think I'm trying to make it the fashion, as I know you are too, Jim and others, is to do things like pulling your socks up over your pants when you're out walking in the woods, for instance. And I mean, there's so many ticks. I grew up in rural Western Maine, and we used to walk through the woods all the time, never saw a tick. I think the first time I saw a tick was around 1999 or 2000. And that was actually when I was living in Brunswick. But if you look, if you Google Maine CDC and ticks, you'll see they have a great website with maps that show the incidence of different tick-borne diseases. And I remember it was the early mid-90s when we saw the first cases of Lyme disease in Maine. It was only really seen down in York County along the beach areas, towns close to the beaches. And now you'll look at the map and you'll see we see Lyme disease statewide, not as much up in Aroostook County. The big hot areas tend to still be in the mid-coast area, but we never used to see it in Franklin County until in recent years. And we also see a number of other, unfortunately, tick-borne diseases like anaplasmosis. I just remember when we'd see one or maybe two a year, and it's now up over 1,000 cases a year of anaplasmosis. Mm. Along with some others. So prevention is the key. And if you're going out, I actually try to stay on trails that are pretty wide and cleared. But even when I'm doing a trail like Bald Mountain and Weld, where there's still quite a few leaves on the trail and the trail is not that wide, I wear long pants, even if it's hot. I've got these kind of nice lightweight insecticide. They have an insecticide in them too from L.L. Bean's pants that are very perfect for hiking, even on a hot day. But I pull my socks up over the pants. I know it doesn't look like, my kids make fun of my fashion sense, but hey, I don't get bitten. And then I take some DEET. I always have some DEET in the car, a DEET containing a 40% DEET spray in the car and at the doorways and places like that. And I spray a little bit around my ankles, spray some on the back of my neck. And they can sometimes hop up. And I wear a lightweight clothing that has long sleeves on top as well. And I try to use the ones that have permethrin in it, embedded in it, like the pants as well. But that
helps mosquitoes not bite you either, too.
Yes, they don't help with black flies. That's the only thing I know. But they do help with mosquitoes and as with ticks. And that's why I use about 35 to 40% DEET containing spray, as well as the clothing. And you can buy clothing and then spray the permethrin. You can buy the permethrin, you can get it ready, and you can spray the clothes. You have to spray it outside and let them dry. But I do that, and knock on wood, I'm not going to lie to you, I haven't had a tick bite in, I think it's probably been at least probably 20 years.
That's wonderful. And the second part of Kim's question is about new treatments or advice that can be shared. And Jim, you were saying that you treated your patient with antibiotics, which has been the treatment for a long time, right?
That is correct. There really is, most people are asking questions, are really asking about Lyme disease. And so for Lyme disease, it's relatively easy to treat with typical antibiotics that we have available to us. And usually a short course is all that's needed. And then it can be used for prophylaxis, meaning that if you were bit by a tick and it looked like it had been there for a longer period of time, that they can give you sometimes just a single dose of antibiotics to protect you from getting Lyme disease. And then similarly, most of the other tick-borne diseases, there are treatments for. Unfortunately, for many of the mosquito-borne diseases, there's only supportive care for those, which is another good reason why, Dora mentioned, wearing something that's protective, both in terms of clothing and in terms of mosquito repellent or mosquito killing chemicals, because those are important as well. And then trying to stay, from a mosquito standpoint, they typically feed at dawn and dusk. And so if you can avoid those time frames, that can help mitigate it a little bit. Like Dora said, unfortunately, black flies seem to be out all the time.
And Dr. Jarvis, what was I going to say? We were talking about the antibiotics. If I remember correctly, the earlier you can start that course, the better, right? I mean, people... I know someone who began a course of antibiotics even before the Lyme disease test result was back, because those first few days are pretty important, right?
Yes, and many times that's exactly what a provider would do, is they may do the they may actually do the studies to see if you've been infected, but start you on the antibiotics. Oftentimes, if they do that test too early, it won't even come back positive. That doesn't mean that you didn't already have the bacterium that causes Lyme in your body. So that, you know, that's the reason why we talk about using a prophylactic dose as a preventative thing. I will say that there is still ongoing trials. Both Maine Health and Northern Light Health are involved in clinical trials right now for a Lyme vaccine. We are hopeful that that will have be very successful. It appears to be doing quite well. The fact that the study is ongoing is a good thing for us. And so hopefully we'll have some more information to share if that becomes available and what needs to be done for it.
All right. We're going to go to Larry calling from Bangor. Larry, nice to hear from you.
Oh, thank you. I'm 80 years old and I've had all the childhood diseases. I'm wondering, in particular, I had German measles that almost killed me. So I'm wondering, should I take the new vaccine or not?
You should be okay, Larry, and good that you survived all of those well. Unless you're traveling to a very high risk area, such as West Texas or traveling abroad, you should be fine, or you work in a high risk area like a healthcare setting, but assuming those both are negative, you should be fine.
Great.
Thank you.
A little bit of good news for today. Before we get to the next break and before we get to some more calls, I'm going to go back to you, Dr. Mills, and talk about an update on whooping cough. Are we seeing it in Maine? Why are people concerned about it?
Yeah, so great questions. So the whooping cough, we've been seeing a big rise in across the country because of the vaccine rates being lower, and particularly post-COVID, a lot of the childhood vaccination rates are lower. So we are seeing more of it around the country. I'm not aware of any outbreaks in the last few weeks here in Maine. But we do certainly concern about it because we're seeing it around the country. The good news about Maine's childhood vaccination rates is that for school children, we have one of the lowest, one of the highest vaccination rates in the country, and the lowest exemption rates, I should say. And that's mostly due, we believe, to the law that passed passed by the voters in 2020, March of 2020. 73% of the voters in Maine, it passed by referendum, a law that says if you are working or go to school in a place that Maine law requires you to have certain vaccinations, then you can be exempt for medical reasons, but not for general philosophical or religious reasons. So since that law went into effect, which I think didn't go into effect really until 2021, our exemption rates for vaccinations amongst school-aged children have risen from some of the lowest in the country to some of the highest in the country. And that's great news for us, because that provides, the rates are high enough that it provides quite a bit of herd immunity, particularly amongst our children. And young children under the age of one are the highest risk for severe whooping cough or pertussis. But having all children who are in daycare and schools with high vaccination rates helps protect those infants.
We'll go to Joe calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Joe, go ahead.
Oh, hi, thank you so much for having this program on. It's so helpful to so many of us. I have a question about the brown recluse spider. Spiders in general, actually. I've seen so many more of them in the last couple of summers. And the brown recluse, I've read, is on the East Coast and goes as far west as Arizona. I'm just wondering if you've seen the toxins that they inflict on folks,
yeah,
and how you treat them.
Thank you, Joe. You know, one of the great things about living in Maine is no poisonous snakes, no poisonous spiders. I know that someday that will no longer be true. Dr. Jarvis, have you seen any brown recluse spider bites?
I have not here in Maine. When I practiced in South Carolina, it was a common occurrence. It was interesting because people used to talk about all the time that people had spider bites. And actually, what we figured out was that most of them weren't spider bites. They were actually that they had MRSA infections and were causing a lesion that looked very similar to what people thought a spider bite looked like. And once we recognized that and treated people appropriately with antibiotics for that particular disorder, calmed down. But yes, unfortunately, the brown recluse spider bite does include a necrotoxin, meaning that it actually dissolves the tissue around where the toxin goes in. Sounds really gross and looks really gross. But thankfully, no, not here in Maine. And I think there's only a few cases of black widow spiders in Maine as well, and that's a neurotoxin. But thankfully, yeah, again, it's one of the nice things about living here. We used to say the same thing about ticks. Unfortunately, we can't do that. It is a word of caution, though, as we talk about climate change, that insects in particular that typically would not survive winters here in Maine may be able to do that. And it's just something that in the future we may need to be more worried about that. I had actually on a recent on a different call-in show had talked about fire ants as being a problem that we're now seeing on the coast of Maine, usually brought up by ships from the southern part, and having had to deal with fire ant bites, we do not want that to happen. So another plug for trying to limit climate change to keep those bugs away from Maine.
And I believe there aren't brown recluse spider is anywhere in New England, or at least Maine and New Hampshire or Vermont. So as yet, but as Jim said, little cautionary tale there with ticks.
Joe, thanks for your question. I'm sure others have the same question. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, medical and health issues. Joining us, Dr. Dora Ann Mills with Maine Health and Dr. Jim Jarvis with Northern Light. Join our conversation. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. At least two topics that we have not discussed that I want to make sure we get in before the end of the program. One is brown tail moth. Just thinking about them makes me itch. Dr. Mills, some good news on that front, right? Uh-oh, you're muted.
Sorry about that. It is, knock on wood and cross every fingers and toes, but they seems to be down this year. I think in part due to there was some fungal outbreaks this last couple of years amongst the population and the moth population, as well as this very rainy, infamous really rainy spring we've had. So right now it seems to be down in the population seems to be down. So knock on wood, hopefully it's true. And we've also had a lot of great municipally led control efforts the last several years. And I think those have really helped people kind of know what to look for in a lot of the places where we've had high numbers of brown tail moths, and they've been doing preventative measures and getting rid of the moths ahead of time and that kind of thing. So I think a combination of efforts have helped a lot.
And how about Dr. Jarvis, you can take this one up. Bird flu, very scary. What do we know?
Yeah, we continue to see outbreaks in certain farms and certain farm animals around the country and around all of North America. So still concerning, thankfully, still not a major concern to the human population, which is good news for us. Many of the isolated cases of humans who have gotten H5N1 had contact with animals, but we do know that they are in the wild bird population, and so that's a concern as things kind of travel and birds kind of then can spread it to other birds, domestic birds, and then unfortunately cattle, like we've seen in several areas.
And I was going to say, an interesting story I read recently on H5N1 is that in a lot of the farms, which have mostly been in out west and in the Midwest that have been impacted by it, these dairy farms with cows being sick from it, they've actually seen a lot of cats. You know, farms always have cats around, right, to keep the mouse population down and all that. but they've actually seen a cat die off very commonly in these farms. And sometimes that's one of the first things that's noticed is that they've had some cats that just kind of quickly died. So just sort of an interesting tidbit. But yeah, I agree with Jim. We've been very fortunate that it hasn't turned into a pandemic, but it is circulating quite widely amongst the bird population, domestic as well as migratory birds, cows and dairy cows, particularly in a lot of states, and even some cats and dogs. So it's still a risk, and we have no idea whether it will turn into the next pandemic or it'll just fizzle. We just don't know, but it's still certainly there in our surveillance systems, our federal and state tracking systems for this disease continue to be very critical.
And on that topic, I want to mention that former Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah, Dr. Nirav Shah, is going to be on Maine Calling next Monday. And our topic will be, are we ready for the next pandemic? So if that's interesting to you, please be sure and tune in on Monday. We'll go to Nick calling from Kittery. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Totally coincidentally, I'm listening to the show this morning. Last week on Wednesday, I noticed a little red spot on my ankle, and I had a annual physical scheduled for Friday. Doctor had a look at it. It was, at that point, it was pretty big, about the size of a silver dollar. And he was rather dismissive about it. You know, no headaches, no fatigue, no fever. You're fine. Well, it's a week later now, and it's now a huge purple circle. I've never had that before. And I'm just kind of curious. You know, the doctor said maybe you should be getting a prophylactic antibiotic while they sort it out. He chose not to. Is there a more firm rule how that should be handled?
Yeah, so things have really changed in the last week. Dr. Jarvis, what's your advice for Nick?
Yeah, one is, I think that, you know, if this continues to get worse, then you really should be seeking out some medical attention, because obviously, you know, we can't do that over the radio here, knowing exactly what that is. But there is no clear cut and fast guideline. Like, if you have this, you should get that kind of thing when it comes to especially skin disorders. And again, in this case, if there wasn't a clear cut indication that there was a tick bite, watchful waiting may be the right approach, or it may have been appropriate to do testing, and really can't comment on that. So for you individually, I think you should probably have that looked at again, especially since you said it was getting worse.
Okay. Good luck to you, Nick. That sounds scary. Let's see, we'll go to Carol from New Hampshire. Hi, Carol, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead. Oh dear, it sounds like we lost Carol. Hopefully she'll call back. So anyway, let's see. We have plenty of questions to go about, though. Here's a question from Alex. What about the shingles vaccine? How essential is it to get that shot, especially if you've had shingles in the past? Dr. Mills, go
ahead. Yeah, talk to your doctor about it. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the shingles vaccine. It is if you've known anybody who's had shingles, it is can be a very severe disease infection. So for sure, you know, talk to your doctor about it, but I would definitely consider getting it. Especially if you're over.
Go ahead, Jim. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I heard you talking. I want to go to an email here from Bruce. He's talking about rabies. He believes that there's a search for a rabid coyote at the Brunswick Naval Air Station, the former Brunswick Naval Air Station. We do know that there have been cases of rabid animals in the Brunswick area over the past few years. And Dr. Jarvis, I'm wondering, rabies is a tricky one, right? Because if you believe you may have been bitten, or you don't know, maybe by a bat, you need to be treated, but it may not be covered and it's really expensive. Tell me your advice.
Yeah, that you're right. It is a very tricky kind of thing to do. So the current recommendations are, if you were to wake up in your room and there's a bat in your room, that you should seek medical attention, because most bats in Maine have very small teeth, and so trying to find puncture marks is often difficult. But unfortunately, bats are a huge reservoir for rabies, as are the rodent population. And usually what happens is the bat bites a rodent and then the bat's infected, and that's how it kind of gets spread. So but there are many places around the state that do have the ability to give prophylaxis rabies vaccines to those individuals who suspect that they have. The other thing is, if you happen to be able to catch the animal, then they may be able to do testing on the animal to see it. As far as insurance goes, that's one of those things that unfortunately we suffer with here in the United States. And one of those, if that's a case that happens where the treatment gets denied for whatever reason, is going through the process to have it reviewed and see if you can get that overturned. But we do have lots of cases of rabies in Maine every year. And unfortunately, again, our wild population does carry rabies.
Yeah, and I just said amongst animal, and Jim is absolutely right. We have them every year amongst particularly bats and some animals like coyotes or foxes or like, but we have not had a human case in Maine since 1937. It was actually a farmer in New Sharon who contracted it from a dog. And of course that was worldwide, that is the most common way people get rabies is from dog bites. But in the United States, since we've been vaccinating dogs for so many years, that's, I don't know as I've ever heard of a dog transmitting rabies in the United States for many, many years. So it is mostly, as Jim said, from bats or from people who've traveled. We had a tragic case in New Hampshire several years ago with a young woman who traveled to Nepal, got a dog bite, and then came back and contracted rabies and could not be saved. I mean, it is nearly 100% fatal once you contract the infection. So good thing to get your dogs and your cats vaccinated, but also is all the preventive measures that Jim mentions too.
Yeah, and I think I misspoke. I might have said rodents. I meant to say skunks. Rodents don't carry rabies. That's one of the myths that people have. So rodents don't carry rabies, but skunks do. And so.
Yeah. And bats are actually mammals, right? They're not birds.
They're not rodents either. Yeah.
We'll go to Carol calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling back. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I understand there is a low, with the vaccines, there's a lot of low things like whooping cough and measles and other things. But how is Maine's autism rate?
Dr. Mills.
You know, and that has been studied for a long time to determine whether the autism increase in the reported autism cases that we've seen over the last 25 years is related to vaccines or not. And multiple studies have really have debunked that theory. That's the good news there.
All right.
Well, I guess my question still is, do you have any idea what the rate is of autism in the state of Maine?
It's not a reportable condition per se. So the rates would be determined by, I think, from hospital or healthcare, or not hospital records, but healthcare records. And I don't know, I think there are some estimates that are national. I've not seen that Maine has a particularly high rate or low rate of autism, but it's not something that you can find easily in the public health literature, just the rates per state, because of the fact that it's not a reportable condition per se.
You know, that's really interesting that you say it's not a reportable condition, because it's interesting to me what things are and what things are not. So if you, I don't want to put you on the spot, Dr. Mills, but what does the state keep records of? What are reportable illnesses? How is it determined what should be reportable? If you could just kind of walk us through that a little bit.
So a number of infectious diseases, there are a lot of reportable diseases, actually, many infectious diseases that the public health can respond to and do something about, right? So, a regular cold is not going to be reportable, but tuberculosis, for instance, and vaccine preventable infections, those kinds of things. And then cancer is a reportable disease because we didn't have, it became a reportable disease probably, I think, in the late 80s or so. And at the time, we didn't have good records from healthcare ability to figure out what healthcare we're seeing in terms of cancers. And that's been very, that the data set from cancer being reportable has been very, very helpful in terms of determining cancer rates by geography and by stage and the like. And then I'm just quickly was Googling, and there are state rates that US CDC has for autism spectrum disorders. And I'm just trying to think of how, because it's not reportable, so I'm not even sure how they get the rates, but they sometimes do this by a survey. So my guess is they've had some sort of survey where they've been able to to estimate some statewide rates. And I don't see that Maine has a particularly high rate on this one, but it's, I'm just scanning it real quickly. But anyway, that is the, yeah, and they're getting it from healthcare, not as reportable disease. This is from the National Health Interview Survey. That is a survey of a small sample of people in each state, and you have to have multiple years of that data to show, usually to show a lot of statewide data. But anyway, so there is something that's on the CDC website from 2019 on autism rates estimates by state. But it's normally not something that's tracked that well, because it's tracked nationally, but not by state, because it's not a reportable disease per se. Or a
Carol, thank you for your question. An email here from Charlotte. We just have a few seconds left. Charlotte writes, I think it's important that doctors test for Lyme disease when patients have certain symptoms. I know of three men who did not have the classic bullseye or recall a tick bite. They all had joint pain. When finally tested for Lyme, they all tested positive. Why is there a reluctance for such testing? This can delay ongoing problems. Jim, I'm suspecting you don't know the answer, and we don't have any time, but anything you'd like to say to Charlotte?
No, other than to say that common things happen commonly, and so we would rule out more common conditions than Lyme disease as being something, you know, without having any other reason to suspect Lyme disease. That's usually the reason why, and sometimes it's just the last resort for us to look for something when we can't find a particular answer. But many people in Maine already have titers positive for Lyme just because of things in the past, and so sometimes it doesn't have utility.
Okay, and there's not enough time to talk about why that's a little confusing, but I thank you both so much, Dr. James Jarvis, Director of Clinical Education for Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center, and Dr. Dora Ann Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.